Today, wars plus inflation plus financial crisis equals... Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and broad news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's Friday and I have Tarek Brooker with me again. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. Welcome to the show. Yeah.
How's the movie running at the moment?
It's looking a bit unbelievable, to be honest. You look at the way things are unfolding, and you'd look at it in a cinema after coming out at the end, and you'd be thinking, I don't know, it seems a bit unbelievable, doesn't it?
Well, the story arc's a bit too complicated, right? There are too many things going on contemporaneously, right? And some of the actions just are plain unbelievable.
Well, they are. I mean, you know, you've got the attack, you know, on the Ukrainian nuclear plant in the south of the country, you know, on the Dnieper River. And it's just, you know, it's just, I mean, someone on Twitter summed it up quite well, and they just said, that's not a headline that I thought I would be seeing anytime soon.
No, exactly right. And there was even somebody in the US suggesting, well, maybe there should be an assassination on the cards. I mean, crazy.
Well, and then the thing about that is it's not just a random someone. It's a sitting US senator, you know, Lindsey Graham, who is, you know, quite a prominent individual. And it's, I don't know. I mean, to me, that sort of rhetoric is rather unhelpful, I think. You know, it's only going to potentially create a rally around the flag sort of thing if they do keep this sort of thing up. And, you know, really that's playing into Putin's hands, especially right now when Russia is suffering so badly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to my mind, the risks of missed policy steps and, you know, missteps and escalation are so grave that people should be really quite cautious about what they say and what they do. But no, we just seem to be ploughing in there and just shaking it all up a bit further. I mean, it doesn't seem to me to be very responsible, frankly.
No, I think that the part of the problem at the moment is that a lot of people are angry, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, some horrific things are happening. But I think that part of the problem is we as humans have a tendency to dehumanize our enemies to at times unfairly target those who really aren't responsible for this. And I'm not referring to the oligarchs or to Putin or to or those types of people. I'm referring to the Russian and Belarusian Paralympians who will now no longer be allowed to compete. You know, I mean, or to the cat people, you know, of Russia, who are now no longer going to be able to bring their cats to international cat shows. I mean, I get what they are trying to do, but I don't really see why cat owners, and perhaps more poignantly, the Paralympians should be forced to pay for that. I mean, you know, not to sound, you know, sort of talking down or anything like that, but haven't Paralympians and stuff suffered enough? You know, many of them have been in horrific accidents, many of them have been through wars. And then, you know, I don't think it's sending the right message. I understand the broader, you know, the broader approach, but I think that a lot in some ways things are being taken it too far. I mean, like, you know, removing War and Peace, you know, Tolstoy's, you know, great epic from reading list because it's written by a Russian, just, it doesn't make any sense to me.
No. But they did that with Nogadin Big Ears previously. So, you know, anything's possible.
Yeah, it's just the nature of things. You know, it's no different than the way things have been before, and it's no different than the way things will eventually be again.
No, but there again, if you're holding commodities or oil stocks, then, you know, they're going through the roof. So somebody's winning, well, at least for now.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the interesting thing, isn't it? You know, you've already got inflation running at north of 5% in the EU, 7.5% in the US, and, you know, there are high numbers around the world which are prompting central banks to raise interest rates. And all that was before a shot was fired in Ukraine, and now you've seen the price of oil go up as much as, well, I think we look at this point looking at almost 30% over the past few weeks, and that's a huge number. I mean, all I can say is a few weeks ago petrol was $2 a litre here in Australia. Yep. If it's going to be $2.60 in a few weeks' time, it's not going to be unpleasant for my wallet or anyone else's.
Well, I for the first time ever, when I filled up the other day, I was over $100. I mean, that was a bit of a shock.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people are going to be experiencing that particular shock. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting that you've got people like, you know, Governor Lowe here at the RBA and Jerome Powell and a few others, you know, sort of saying that this whole Russia-Ukraine thing is giving them a bit of pause, which to me just seems a bit counterintuitive considering the fact that this is almost certainly going to result in higher inflation. And, I mean, we haven't even got into the potential issues of counter sanctions from the Russians yet. That's mostly been, you know, isolated. Although I will say in the last 12 hours or so, apparently the Russians have come out and said that all the aircraft that their airlines have been leasing, this is at least according to some reports, I'm not sure if it's been confirmed yet, but the aircraft that they're leasing from various firms, mostly in Europe, that they're just going to keep them. But they just said, well, we're not going to give them back. Let's get stuffed. We need them. And, you know, apparently there's over 500 aircraft. So you're talking about billions and billions of dollars worth of aircraft. They're just, oh, those are out now. But, I mean, by the same token, that's what's happening to Russian assets, you know, around the world. So, you know, Sergei Lavrov, who is the Russian foreign minister, promised a tit-for-tat response. And I guess that's what we're getting.
Absolutely. And, you know, one oligarch in the UK is now selling his football team.
Well, you know, one thing I just find really interesting about all this is, yes, you know, obviously, you know, the oligarchs have benefited enormously from Putin's reign. There's a lot of corruption, a lot of dodginess, you know, a lot of supporting of, you know, shall we say, you know, less than savory activity. But I think it's interesting that we're targeting the Russian oligarchs, yet we have Chinese oligarchs and all sorts of dodgy people from all over the world doing all sorts of things with assets, including buying our houses.
Absolutely. Yeah, it does seem to be, you know, it depends on the particular perspective at a particular point in time. And talking of perspectives and point in time, we should get onto the charts or we're going to run out of time.
Well, that is the challenge, isn't it? All right, well, we'll get started.
Okay.
Okay, for anyone who wants to follow along more closely or wants to find a source or just look at the charts in greater detail, they are available at avidcom.substack.com, as you can see right there. So we'll kick off. Now, this one, I thought it'd be interesting if we would start today with a bit of a snapshot of how things were before Russia invaded Ukraine, because I think that that's obviously going to dominate data. It's going to dominate news and narratives from this point onwards. So I think it would be interesting to have a little bit of a touchstone as to how things were beforehand, because I can guarantee there's going to be a lot of people who are going to scapegoat this situation for everything from economic downturns to inflation, even though we already have both of those problems to varying degrees in varying places. So this one is the US ISM Services Index, which has basically been rolling over now for quite some time, which is quite concerning considering the fact that the US is now basically just, you know, throwing its doors open, things are returning to normal, and you would expect that would result in, well, stronger services activity, significantly stronger. But it turns out the expansion of the services sector is actually slowing down. And perhaps more importantly, as an indicator, if you look closely there at the employment sub-index, which is noted there in that yellowy orange, it's contracting again. And if you look back all the way pre-COVID, it was never contracting. Even when the US economy was slowing down, even when the yield curve began to invert, it wasn't in contraction. And considering the fact that services is now a huge part of the US economy, it's not exactly a fantastic sign.
No, but the point you are making is, and we'll see, I think, more charts to show this, you know, they now have an alibi, right? Whereas previously things were going pear-shaped and they didn't really have any excuse. Now they've got one.
Yeah, exactly. And I expect Putin, it's all Putin's fault. It's all Putin's fault to ring out in the halls of power around the world, even though obviously, you know, we all know that there were some fairly significant problems before that. Now, this is a Eurozone producer prices, and it's just, what do you say?
What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are looking at, you know, sort of just six, five, almost six times, the highs that we've seen over the last 35 years in terms of European producer prices. And it just goes to show that you know, inflation is a major, major issue. And the really concerning thing about this is a snapshot of what things look like before the war in Ukraine. You know, what is it going to look like now that oil's gone up 30%, now that gas, European gas, is at an all-time high, and coal has just gone past the moon, and it's currently heading for Mars?
Yes, well, that's exactly right. And there's always a bit of a lag, isn't there, in terms of, you know, how these indices are showing, because we're looking in the rearview mirror, right? So you've got to assume it's going to get significantly more pressurized ahead.
Well, exactly. It's only going to get more challenging from here. Mm. I mean, eventually, obviously, there will be a pullback and there will be a crash when either prices get too high or we see some form of geopolitical resolution. But who knows when that'll happen? You know, right. Just because it will happen eventually, it doesn't mean it's going to happen anytime soon.
And as we said in one of our previous shows, something could break in the process.
I think that's fairly likely at this point. I mean, you know, we're already seeing things breaking around the world. And I think that it's been absolutely remarkable to watch how resilient markets have been in the face of this, in the face of, you know, the potential of a clash of the superpowers in, you know, essentially cutting 2% of the entire global economy out, when that 2% of the global economy provides all manner of things to the West, including, I believe someone said on Twitter the other day, 40% of the fertilizer flowing into Europe.
Yeah, that's quite a thought, isn't it? And, you know, I think markets often try to look over immediate short-term things and say, well, of course, it'll be sorted out, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Except that the path to resolution, to me, is completely unclear at the moment. And, you know, the other point, I think, is that markets will also be saying, well, of course, the Fed won't do much. You know, they'll keep pumping if necessary to keep everything okay, because that's what they've done for the last decade. So those two things, I think, have been part of the reason why the markets have not reacted more negatively, although, in fact, if you look carefully, there are some very strong negative reactions, offset, of course, by the rising commodities and, you know, stock prices of some of the miners have been very strong as a result of this in the oil sector. But nevertheless, I don't think markets have factored in what the reality probably is, really.
No, I mean, I think that there are certain places, say, like, let's be honest, probably Australia, where the, you know, our central bank, the Reserve Bank, will probably want to hold off raising interest rates for as long as humanly possible, you know, and that's likely true in Europe as in particular as well, because, you know, even if you have a couple of countries jumping up and down trying to encourage the ECB and its governor Christine Lagarde to do something, it's not the same as it is in the US, where inflation is a major issue. Mm-hmm. And you've got, you know, a very clear and direct link between the US government and governmental pressure and inflation, whereas in the ECB, there's this entire, you know, EU organization between, you know, an angry leader and Christine Lagarde. Whereas basically, you know, on the other hand, Joe Biden can get Jerome Powell on the phone and said, do something about this right now or else. And we both know what Jerome Powell will do.
Yes. And of course, the inflation issue was one of those things that was mentioned in the State of the Union address this week by Biden.
Indeed. And more about inflation. Now, this shows that, well, EU inflation is currently at a record high. Now, I should point out that this isn't the highest in European history, but it is the highest in the history of the European, of the formal European Union. And I mean, 5.8%, you know, in a zone where that encompasses places like Greece, where they face a highly challenging time, where, you know, the economy has never fully recovered from the financial crisis and the Eurozone debt crisis. And frankly, there isn't the wage growth and there isn't the economic growth to keep up with this type of inflation. I mean, in the US, obviously, they are struggling badly and they have even higher inflation. But at least in the US, you could make an argument that they can actually grow their economy to a greater degree to somewhat mitigate that. But in the EU, they've got real problems.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think people need to think about is the inflation rate relative to wages growth, right? Because in a lot of the European countries, there's no wages growth at all. So a lot of people are going to find simply that it's going to get harder and harder just to stand still.
Well, exactly. And, you know, you're also going to see things like it, like pressures on bonds as well. I mean, you know, the ECB is still buying 100% of net issuance. And, you know, if they are forced by inflation or by politics eventually to start paring that back, you're going to see some really, really big problems within the EU bond market. It's not really a market anymore. It's just, you know, it's a patient on life support. You know, it's alive, sort of, but that's it. You know, if you take away that support, it's not going to be able to stand on its own.
Absolutely.
Okay, now, since we've finished the snapshot of things before Ukraine, now let's talk about some of the things that could occur as a result. Now, this is a chart that shows the impact of, the percentage of exports which come from various different countries, mostly in Europe, to Russia and to Ukraine. Now, Slovakia and Hungary are the two most exposed, but also just goes to show that places, say, for example, like Britain, India, and the US, they're not really exposed to this at all. So it's going to be a very, very European problem in that regard, in terms of our overall economic impact. However, the problem with the Russian export story and the issue with exports coming out of Russia is that Russia controls sizable proportions of various commodities, food, etc., that sort of disproportionately impact households and the cost of living.
That's exactly right. And we already know, of course, that, you know, gas is a problem. We also know that corn is a problem and a few other things too. And I was listening to some the other day reminding us that some of the high-tech companies in Ukraine were actually responsible for some of the apps that are used in many mainstream online programs across the world. So I hadn't quite appreciated just how entrenched the use of those technological capabilities were, supporting, you know, many, many different ones.
Well, I think that's a story that's present across the board. There are all sorts of these little links that flow through the globalized economy, through Russia, through Ukraine, and impact, you know, so many different things in our daily lives. And, you know, I think that's going to be a challenge that we're going to confront in the weeks and months and potentially even years ahead as this all plays out, because a lot of things aren't immediately apparent. They take time for these, you know, second and third order effects to become clear.
Absolutely. For another example, some of the large tech companies have help desk operating out of Ukraine.
Well, there you go. Exactly.
They might go off air.
Well, quite possibly. Now, one of the big ones is the global food supply. Ukraine and Russia combined account for just almost 16% of the world's seaborne exports of food. Of grain. And one of the key things as well to keep in mind when looking at this is it's highly seasonal. If you look at, say, something like corn, for example, there are periods in the year, mostly around the springtime, the European spring, toward the end, where Ukrainian corn accounts for 24% of all corn in the world being harvested and shipped out at that time. And as you can see, the ports from which these grains are exported are all on the Black Sea. Some of them have already been captured or they're currently under attack. And they are huge. They are the objectives of the Russian armed forces to take those key locations. Those are the places that they've been attacked and those are the places that they want. And the problem that you're then left with is, especially with the backdrop of sanctions, of hostility, ongoing hostility, whether it's diplomatic or otherwise, in the months and years to come, is you're going to have Ukrainians with grain and the potential for the Russians to be holding the ports. And how does that work? Is Europe going to create, you know, going to send this massive of trains to send to ship all this grain to other ports in Europe? You know, are they going to have to make some sort of deal with the Russians or what? I mean, any interruption to supply of such a large magnitude of the world's food could create some really sizable problems. Even if the supply itself is only moderately interrupted, it could cause an outsized reaction in prices.
Yeah, and if you overlay then some of the other issues, for example, some of the adverse climate conditions that we've had in other parts of the world to also grow grain as well, there are already tight supplies in some areas. So this is going to actually, again, put huge pressure on just the basic price of staples.
Indeed, and it's also the fact that, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but you know, a large swaths of the grain producing regions of Ukraine are war zones. The equipment is being destroyed. You know, fields are being impacted. You know, farmers are unfortunately being killed. And I mean, I think one of the interesting ones is if you look at production of agricultural production during the time of the Soviet Union towards the late 1940s and early 1950s, because you've seen the end of the immediate impact of the Nazi invasion, and you're seeing what the aftermath is in terms of, you know, equipment being destroyed, farmers being killed, etc. And Soviet grain production doesn't recover to 1940 levels for almost 15 years.
Yep.
Now, if we see anything approaching that, now obviously the level of devastation, the level of deaths during that period was much, much, much higher. But in today's world, we're much, much more reliant on farm equipment, on mechanization, on fertilizers, on all these different things. And the question then becomes, if there is US and Western sanctions in place on Russia, and there's these, you know, great swaths of the Ukraine where farm equipment, all these necessary things have been destroyed, how is that going to impact overall agricultural production? How many years is it going to take to get back to pre-war levels? And that's a question that doesn't really have an answer. And it's something, well, I mean, and we're not going to know the extent of the damage until the war is eventually over.
Absolutely. And these things have a habit of going on for a long, long time and creating waves in unexpected places.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I don't think that there's much appetite for a protracted war in Russia. I think that they're going to want to accomplish their objectives and then, you know, put in some occupational forces and then go home. But, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in that regard. I mean, also, you know, in insurgencies may target the equipment of people who they see as collaborators. You know, you don't know. And that's part of the great uncertainty we face here. And Things could get quite challenging for the global food supply, and that is the absolute worst possible thing that can happen. Well, not the worst possible thing, but it's up there. Yep. Especially for, you know, developing countries where food is a much greater proportion of overall costs than it perhaps is here in Australia or elsewhere.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, there are two little words that have been quite prominent in the last few days, and indeed in the last few months. The words, since 2008, we've got the highest inflation since 2008. We've got the highest commodity prices since 2008, even though commodity prices have now broken to record highs overall. And now we have the highest oil price since 2008. Now, I'm not going to put in any spoilers here, but I think the viewers know how all that ended in 2008.
What are you suggesting, Tarek?
Well, I'm suggesting that inflationary pressures usually don't end well. Normally they either, you know, they end up in deflation as a result of, you know, basically just prices become too high, people stop purchasing, and then, you know, you often see a recession. Although, generally speaking, when you see oil prices this high, the yield curve behaving in the way that it is, I believe it's 6 out of the last 6 times that's happened, there's been a recession.
Yep. Yep.
And inflation is an absolute shed load higher than it has been in most of those instances.
Yeah, and there's two factors to think about. One is the pure economic numbers as they come through. But the other is the psychology and, you know, the confidence that the people have, because quite often the decaying of confidence actually leads to rather adverse economic outcomes. And it's interesting that if you look at some of the confidence numbers that have come out recently in Australia and other places too, it's all pretty negative, not surprising given everything. But that is a situation where people perhaps will spend less rather than more because of the higher expectations on inflation, because of the greater levels of uncertainty, et cetera, et cetera. So those two things together can be sort of be yin and yang effectively to create a pretty nasty situation. And then, of course, the question is, so does that mean that central banks have to cut rates again, and do they have to actually throw more liquidity in to try and actually do what they did, you know, after the global financial crisis? Except, of course, that we're in a rather different position in terms of the level of interest rates and the amount of debt that's outstanding. So if they wanted to do a similar thing to last time around, they'd have to take rates negative, and they'd have to actually increase the amount of debt in the system substantially. How can they do that when inflation is so high?
No, exactly. I mean, there's no real political appetite for that at the moment. Now, obviously, that could change if you see, you know, a hard-hitting economic downturn. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, inflation is the major problem now. And the truth is no one, with everything going on in Ukraine now, no one knows when inflation is finally going to peak and is finally going to run out of gas. You know, not that long ago, the broad consensus of quite a large swath of Wall Street, excuse me, was that we would see inflation head back towards 2% towards the end of the year, early next year. But with everything going on in Ukraine, with all that yet to feed through into the system, we just don't know. I mean, it's going to be interesting to watch regardless.
And Jerome Powell, when he was giving evidence this week to the Banking Commission in the US, basically had to admit that, you know, the likelihood is that the Ukraine situation would keep inflation higher for longer. And, you know, he did say, well, we're not sure exactly how it's going to play out. So a level of uncertainty there as well.
Well, I think in a lot of ways that just illustrates how they need to be, well, how they needed to be more proactive on tightening policy earlier. You know, because now we are we're confronting this situation where we may see a, you know, 1970s oil shock type impact on the global economy, but a much more broad based one, not just oil. Perhaps it won't be as strong in terms of, well, it won't be as strong in terms of the upward price pressure on oil, but it's much more broad based. It's gas, it's food, it's absolutely everything. And it's not just the knock on effect from higher oil prices this time. So I think that that's something that where we've been left really, really vulnerable, because there isn't anything left in the tank. You know, we've spent all the money fiscally. We've thrown all the stimulus at it from a monetary policy perspective. And it's like, well, what do we do now? We're out of ammo. We can't really do anything without potentially making the problem worse. Now, that could change in time, but for now, you know, now we've got a problem.
Well, the only way out would be to take interest rates negative and to hand out money directly from the central bank to households and businesses so that they can spend some more, right?
Yeah.
Which will be the next logical circle of this quantitative easing program, right? It's almost like some sort of universal basic income or equivalent, right? But that then takes us to another very interesting position, right? Because what they'd be trying to do would be to try to force people with savings to spend those rather than keep them, because the value would be diminished because of negative interest rates. And then they would be throwing more money at households and businesses to try and actually get them to consume. But, you know, trying to force feed people when they're not really that hungry could be a problem. And that's going to cost. So, you know, there are paths that they could follow, but they're not comfortable paths. And the risks attached to them pretty significant, I'd have thought.
Well, I agree. I mean, you've got a situation in that instance whereby you're just inviting a wage price, you know, wage price feedback loop of just ever increasing wage demands. Because, you know, if you've got you know, say, you know, a health union who is negotiating their pay rises for the next couple of years, and they're seeing inflation at, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% potentially, they're not going to be satisfied with 2, 3, or 4. They're going to want something that at least gets in the ballpark of keeping up with the cost of living. And that's the risk in all of this. And that's one of the few things that central banks really fear. And that's one of the reasons why I think that when push comes to shove, they're going to have to raise rates. And they're going to, even if they have to do so, you know, being dragged kicking and screaming by the politicians.
Well, you know, the guy in charge of the Bank of England some time ago said, well, you know, we want to encourage people not to seek wage price increases, right, despite the high inflation, right? It was almost a sort of a plea, please don't.
Well, you should just get a T-shirt that just says stop being poor.
Yeah, that's, you know, right.
You know, it's just, it's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about the impact of the war in Ukraine so far has been how the sanctions have had sort of, I'm not going to call them entirely unintended side effects, but they've gone further than some might have otherwise expected. For example, no one is buying some varieties of Russian oil. There is oil from the Urals, which keeps going up for auction. They're offering enormous discounts, you know, and it can't catch a bid because it's radioactive and nobody wants to touch it, just in case something happens or there's issues with insuring the shipment or any number of other things. And then on the other side of the coin, you've got the fact that, you know, that Russia is the number one exporter of fertilizer in the world, and it's having the effect that absolutely anyone and everyone would have thought it would have. Fertilizer prices are going through the roof. In the US, some farmers are reporting paying 300% more. So, you know, it's a mess.
Yeah, and those input costs flow ultimately on, don't they? Or if they can't get that fertilizer, the yields drop, which means that the volume of production falls, which means that the price goes up. So whichever way you look at it, we're snookered. Yeah,
exactly. And that's the risk. That's one of the risks here, that you see this feedback loop of less agricultural production, higher fertilizer prices, you know, both as a result of sanctions and as a result of, you know, damaged equipment and just issues with frankly, you know, the world, one of the world's breadbaskets being the front line in a major war. So, you know, this is all going to take time to feed through the system, and it's going to hit all of us at the supermarket checkout.
Absolutely. Yep. wherever you look, like I said, that plot gets a bit thick.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, it's a bit, you know, it's a little bit crazy. I mean, you know, thinking about it, you know, you're going down the biscuit aisle, and you're like, oh wow, that's quite a bit more expensive. And you go, oh, it's the war. You know, it's just it's so far away, yet obviously we're all gonna feel it to some degree.
And it's interesting because some of the voices out of Europe have basically said, look, those costs will go up, but it's a price we have to pay because of the war, right? They're actually now already justifying those price increases because of what's going on there, and because we have to defend ourselves from, you know, Russia and what they're doing. That excuse is being rolled out quite quickly.
I do wonder how much legs that narrative is going to have. Now, I know right now, while the TV screens are filled with, you know, the horrific events going on in Ukraine, once people start feeling it in the hip pocket, I wonder how that's going to evolve, because, you know, we, as a species, we can be quite a self-interested lot.
Just a bit.
Now, there is this idea out there that isn't terribly well thought out, but that basically that Europe can flip a switch and then just, you know, take all these LNG cargoes and, you know, just ensure that they're no longer reliant on Russian gas. But as this chart shows, that's just not it's just not possible in the short term. The capacity for LNG imports, it just really isn't there. You know, they don't have the facilities to take that those cargoes. They don't have the systems to transmit those cargoes in the same way, because they would need to be retrofitted. And it's also just the fact that there's only so much LNG in the world, and most of it flows to Asia. It flows from Australia and the Middle East to Asia, and that's what they overwhelmingly use. So, you know, there are no easy solutions in that regard, and you know, any transition is going to take time. This idea that we can just cut Russia off and, you know, everything will be hunky-dory and that we have alternatives in the short term, it isn't really real in that regard. You know, I guess, you know, we should just be, you know, somewhat thankful, depending on your perspective, that Russia has kept the gas on thus far.
It's interesting because Europe has about 6 weeks of gas stored at this time of year. And they're coming out of the coldest period now, 6 weeks, right? And they really would be in significant pressure quite quickly. But of course, think forward till next winter when the demand peaks again, like we saw in November last year when prices in gas were very high. You can see that this is going to be a huge problem. And the chances of being able to reconfigure all those supply chains and, you know, redirect all of those tankers, well, where are you going to redirect them from, firstly, right? And secondly, how are you going to be able to plug into the system? I mean, those are not things that you can solve in just a few weeks.
No, exactly. I mean, there was an energy analyst, I believe, from Reuters, who did a bit of an analysis on this recently. And he was saying that even if you redirected every single LNG cargo that goes to China, to Europe next winter, it's nowhere near enough to replace the flow of Russian gas. And then you obviously have the side effect of China having no gas from an LNG perspective. So, you know, it's not, there are no easy solutions here. And, you know, and I know that it's easy at the moment to just, you know, just grab a hold of, well, you know, screw Russia. We're going to do X, we're going to do Y. But the reality of things, the just the pure logistics of things are quite a lot more challenging in that regard.
And I'll give you one more example of that. You know, Germany's been weaning itself off nuclear for the last few years since the Japanese experience, and they were expecting to be pretty much out of it. I think something like capacity of maybe up to 4% could be generated if they actually stuck with it. So even, you know, at their peak, nuclear wasn't a big mix. But the point there is that it's marginal. So even if they left the existing nuclear system in place a bit longer, it's not going to be enough to be able to replace all of the gas that's disappearing potentially. They have a significant challenge in terms of trying to work out what the replacement program is, and they're talking about, you know, a green solution, et cetera, et cetera. But again, this is not going to be just in a few months. This is going to take a long, long time. So energy and the cost of energy and the solution to how you deal with it actually really raises its head dramatically. Now, there's two arguments there. The first is that might bring forward some of the green solutions, which may help with regard to global warming, etc. Or it might actually create a knee-jerk reaction and sort of, well, what have we got? Well, is there coal we can get, you know, if we grab anything? So we might actually find that it goes the other way. So, you know, again, trying to actually sort of decode this and think about how it all plays out is very complex, but there are no easy solutions once again.
No, and in the short term, I personally tend to think that the latter, the switch back to more traditional energy measures, is realistically the only short-term choice if they do want to wean themselves off of Russian gas. But then by the same token, if you want to switch away from gas-fueled heating to electric fueled heating powered by coal, is the capacity there in the power grid to do that, which is then a whole other issue. Yep. So, you know, there's all these different things that need to be considered from a very, very broad overview level, rather than just, you know, like this, as you say, a knee-jerk thing of let's do this. And, you know, it's obviously quite a lot more complex.
And I think it's quite interesting that the previous chancellor was very wedded to Russia in terms of this German chancellor, to Russia in terms of, you know, gas and et cetera. The current incumbent now seems to be steering a completely different path. So, you know, Germany is turning on a sixpence, really. to try and actually re-architect its energy policy. Very interesting to see that play out.
It is, but one of the things I think is going to be really interesting is once this immediate crisis passes, because right now everything's very politically popular, everything's very, you know, appealing, and, you know, there's a lot of public support behind it. But once push comes to shove and you're left with a situation where, say, for example, in Germany, you've got quite a powerful green movement. And that, and when I say powerful, I mean powerful in a political sense, in terms of, you know, a sizable representation in parliament. They're not going to be happy about you going back, about Germany going back to coal. You know, they're going to be pissed about it. And while they may not like Vladimir Putin and they may not like Russia, they may like this alternative even less. Now, people can debate the righteousness of that till the cows come home, but that is the reality that Germany and other European countries will have to confront, particularly those that are very, very reliant on Russian gas, because it's not just a flip of a switch.
Absolutely. That shows how complicated and interwoven this whole situation is.
No, who thought globalization was a good idea, right?
Put the fences back up.
Okay, now, I just love this graph, because it just goes to show how the issues with Ukraine have hit the commodity markets like a ton of bricks. It is the largest weekly move in commodity prices, on an upward move, I should say, since 1974, since the oil crisis. And it just goes to show just how quickly that this is occurring. And frankly, if this keeps up, things are going to start to break in relatively short order. You cannot have oil prices rocketing 30% like that. You can't have wheat prices going limit up pretty much every day. It cannot keep happening. Societies are going to break and economies are going to break. So the question is, what breaks first? What is going to occur that's going to finally start to either put downward pressure on commodity prices or downward pressure on the real economy, so we can afford to pay for these high commodity prices?
It's worth just adding that that's one of the reasons why the Australian stock market is actually not performing as badly as some others, right? Because, of course, we are highly exposed to the commodities sector. Some of those large mining companies have started to do quite well, and some other sectors too, because we are actually seen as a bit of a hedge by some international investors now.
Well, there was a recent announcement by the National Development Council in China telling its commodity buyers to basically buy up whatever they could get their hands on that's key to the Chinese economy. So you're talking about grains, you're talking about iron ore, you're talking about oil, etc. And they basically, and when asked about what price, you know, what sort of price point they were looking at, they basically said, well, price doesn't matter. And that's something that is, as you say, very much benefiting the Australian stock market at the moment, the Australian dollar, because at the moment, it's no longer about price. It's about ensuring supply. And Australia will benefit from that in the short term. But, you know, for every boom, eventually, there will be a bust.
Well, that's right, because we might be generating more export income. But if we have to pay a lot more at home for those same goods, people aren't going to be very happy about that.
No, because ultimately Australia is a consumer economy.
Yep.
You know, we are. I mean, what is it, about 70% of the economy is consumer driven?
It's certainly 60-ish plus.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, 60-70%. Yep. So, you know, on one hand, you're like, oh, great, you know, we're selling all this coal for $300, $400 a ton, LNG through the roof, but we're paying $3 a litre for petrol.
Yep.
So, double-edged sword.
And ask where those cash flows coming back into those big companies ultimately end up. A lot of them don't end up in Australia.
People don't need to know that. You know, the narrative is, oh, look at the booming mining sector, look at it. When in actual fact, it, you know, a lot of it flows. I mean, some of these mining companies are 80% foreign owned.
Correct. Absolutely. So no, we hardly see anything of it. Right. So we register the gross amount, but the net that actually lands back in the Australian economy in terms of tax take and in terms of actually, flowing through to the local economy is way, way, way smaller, which is one reason why there's such a disconnect between the, you know, the commodity cycle and what's happening there and what real people and real businesses are feeling in Australia at the moment.
But I mean, that's the way it's been really since the end of the mining construction boom, you know, like the actual, when I say mining construction boom, I mean the construction of the actual infrastructure for the mines rather than the boom in prices itself. That is what really picked Australia up and dusted it off after the financial crisis. So it's going to be interesting to watch. You know, there's all these different forces, and I guarantee whoever's treasurer at the time, whether it's Jim Chalmers or Josh Frydenberg or someone else entirely, they're going to crow about it.
Of course. Well, he did this week when the latest results came out, you know, and the growth was quite strong. But if you look carefully again, you know, actually there were some very negative numbers in there in terms of the savings ratio was down, the real income growth was much lower. I mean, you know, you can spin it any way you like. And productivity per capita, well, it wasn't really good. So it depends on which metrics you pick, I suppose.
Well, you pick the headline ones that are good, don't you? You pick those ones, you go, ta-da!
Yeah, exactly, which is precisely what I did. And he even had his slides. Didn't know whether you saw the presentation he gave, but he actually had the ABS slides up and he was able to sort of show this big spike up, right? Except, of course, that it doesn't tell the full story.
Well, no, it doesn't tell you that that households on average, the ones that were receiving wage growth on average, went back by half a percent in Q4. Yep. So, you know, things are going so fantastic, households are going backwards. That really should be the focus.
Absolutely. And we know that income growth in real terms is negative and is likely to stay that way with such high inflation.
Yeah, well, unfortunately so. And inflation may only pick up from here. And wages growth looks awful. To be completely honest, considering the inflationary pressures we face.
And did you notice how Phil Lowe redefined on the Tuesday statement? You know, he'd been talking about wages growth and he's now talking about the cost of labour. So he's actually got this broader measure now, which he's looking instead, right? So we've redefined the problem again.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it's so, you know, maybe he saw our show. Maybe he saw our show last week and we were talking and we shared that chart of the number of households receiving a pay rise being less than 30%. Yep. And he was like, oh, well, we better focus on something else then.
Yeah. Hey, Phil, we've got another idea for you.
Well, speaking of inflation-adjusted incomes, in the US, it's been rolling over since the Biden stimulus package in March and April 2021. Mm. And I particularly like this chart because it shows basically how real household disposable income leads consumption. And generally speaking, goods consumption is roughly on par or slightly less than real household disposable income. Yet right now, it's significantly more. Mm. So I think that just goes to show that well, people we're in for a bit of a challenging time in the months ahead as all this stimulus is finally withdrawn, because you know we're still yet to see the full result particularly in the US when they remove the child tax credit and the student loan repayment holiday of those particular things being removed, because they're worth around about 1.5% of GDP, which is a sizable amount of stimulus.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth reflecting, of course, that again is pre-Russia, right?
Yes.
So, you know, we expect to see that. And the amount of stimulus that's being removed now is quite strong. And, you know, the jobs numbers last time around from the US weren't looking too bad. But again, if you look carefully at where the wages growth is, it's not uniformly spread. Funnily that. And, you know, costs are very strong, as we said earlier on. So, again, we have to come back to this is fragile. This economy in the US is fragile.
Yeah, and exactly. And I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said that this is how it was before the issues with Russia. You know, I can only imagine how much, you know, real household incomes are going to suffer if inflation does pick up significantly. If you do see the full rise in oil prices being priced into things like, you know, heating oil into... Or more particularly as you head into spring and summer, into US gasoline prices, because nothing pisses Americans off more. Well, almost nothing pisses Americans off more than paying more, a lot more for petrol prices, especially as they set off for their summer road trips.
Yeah. Well, the 60 million release of barrels of oil will make almost no difference at all, right?
Well, you sit there for, say, what is it? I mean, in terms of global consumption, about 15, 16 hours, and just like, and it's all gone.
Exactly. Yes. When I first looked at it, I thought, are they missing a nought?
Well, exactly. It's a statistical nothing, you know. And considering how much, oil supplies are being interrupted from Russia, I mean, you've got ships hitting mines in the Black Sea. You know, so a lot of tankers are not willing to go there. And then the tankers that are going to Russia, because of the issues with insurance, because of the potential issues with sanctions, some of them are charging, you know, 5, 6, 7 times as much. So a lot of people aren't willing to touch these cargoes with a 10-foot pole. So whatever little we see from, you know, the release of strategic reserves, it's just a big fat nothing. And to be completely honest with you, I think it's rather foolhardy considering the fact that there is a very real possibility that we could see an oil crisis type scenario where we need those reserves just to keep things, just to keep the basics going.
And did you notice that ScoMo, of course, authorized some of our strategic stock, which is in the US, would be part of that 60,000? Hang on.
Oh, well, so we've got a little nothing on top of a gigantic nothing.
Yeah, exactly right. But it's in the US.
Yeah. Oh, it's just for a country as, you know, for a country as rich in minerals and rich in resources as we are, you'd think that we could be self-sufficient. We could have enough fuel and all these things to look after ourselves. But No, we spend billions on submarines instead to protect the petrol that has to come from over, that has to be refined overseas using Australian oil and then brought back to Australia.
Yep.
Yet for a fraction of the cost of those submarines, we could have just nationalized the refineries and ensured the supply. So,
yep, I know.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But you know, I mean, that's a lot of politics.
Sense went out of the window many years ago, in my view.
Oh, Lord. Okay, now this is the last one for the day. Basically, it shows that normally in recent years when we have seen these big downturns in stock prices, normally corporate insiders come in and they buy. You saw a big, big spike in corporate insiders buying in during the crash in 2020. Yet this time, even though stock prices are falling, even though market sentiment is apparently very, very, you know, very bearish, which normally prompts the corporate insiders to come out and buy, they're not buying. They're not buying this easy bounce back narrative, which is really interesting that they're not buying it now, but they did buy it during the COVID crash.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that if you look at now forward guidance on future earnings in the US, they've started to come down, which suggests that people in corporate land know that actually things are going to be a lot tighter ahead. And the profitability boom that we had thanks to low interest rates and being able to buy back shares, et cetera, that's all over, right?
Yeah.
And now the cost of debt's rising, as well as the global uncertainty that we've touched on earlier on. So maybe it's not too surprising that they are just keeping their powder a little dry at the moment. Interestingly, I was talking to somebody who's, you know, in the markets quite significantly. And they were saying it's interesting that a lot of the buying and selling at the moment is still those retail investors, you know, the relatively naive investors who are buying the dip and, you know, thinking that it's a good time to buy, et cetera. Again, some of the professional investors have been sitting on the sidelines other than maybe buying oil and some commodity-related stuff in the short term. There's more going on under the hood in terms of market dynamics than many people think, I think, at the moment. Plus, of course, the other factor which people need to understand is that there is a computer trade mechanism working all the time. Well, so when there's volatility, there's a whole bunch of market movements just driven by the computer saying, right, now time to sell or now time to buy. So that is exacerbating some of these significant movements that we're seeing, which is one of the reasons why volatility is so high. But actually, a lot of the insiders, a lot of the people who are actually professional investors are biding their time and sitting on the sidelines and just waiting to see what happens.
Well, it's a pretty concerning backdrop, isn't it? You know, you look at things. You've got had the potential of a great power conflict. You've got the inflationary issues that are going to stem from Ukraine, you know, and you've got the withdrawal of, you know, stimulus domestically in the US. It's a pretty challenging backdrop for stock earnings. And really, I just think it goes to show how resilient markets have been in the face of just a very, very challenging reality.
Well, now I want to sort of take you back to Hollywood, right, and the director's suite. Now, you know, you're sort of halfway through the story, right, and you think, now, what else can I bring in that would actually add a bit of an extra drama, right? So I've got two suggestions for you. The first one is that China goes after Taiwan, right, just to add another flank, right? Or what about a comet that suddenly appears and looks as though it's heading straight for us, right? That would just seem to me to be the gilt on the gingerbread.
No, that would just be bullish, you know. well, you know, everyone would just be like, no, look, we got to buy stocks here because if we don't buy them, and it hits, well, you know, doesn't really matter. You're all Dunskies anyway. But if you buy them and it doesn't hit, well, you know, you're going to see this blow off in spending because everyone's like, hooray, we're alive.
Yeah,
but you know, as for China and Taiwan, you know, not that long ago, it was generally sort of thought of as unlikely, and you know, I was not quite in that camp, but I wasn't someone who thought that it was going to happen, you know, going to occur with any real immediacy. That it was something that was potentially years and years down the road. But now, I mean, I don't know. It's a really uncertain world out there. And you know, I think that it's going to be really key to watch how the Taiwanese react to this and how the West not only the traditional West, but the Japanese as well react to this, because, you know, Ukraine borders NATO, you know, Ukraine borders all these NATO countries, you know, Romania, Poland, etc.
Yep.
We can ship weapons across the border, you know, every day. You know, it's just you hop in your truck, you drive across the border, you're there, you know. But if something like this, if a shocking invasion of Taiwan was to occur, yes, you can send aircraft, yes, you can send ships, but these things take time, and you can only send so much by air. You know, there are limits, and I think it just really goes to show that if we do see the West starting to really, you know, ramp up their arming of Taiwan, you know, it could create a rather challenging scenario, because the more well-armed Taiwan becomes, the harder it becomes for Beijing. And, you know, they don't want it to become that much harder. You know, for the longest time, they've had it all their own way. They've, you know, they've gone from being a nothing navy, really, you know, capable of doing very little except, you know, their own territorial waters, into something, you know, relatively impressive, something that's relatively capable. I mean, obviously they've never seen any real full-scale combat, but it adds that different dimension. But the more well-armed Taiwan becomes, if someone just goes, we're going to give Taiwan, you know, all these anti-air, anti-missile, anti-ship capabilities in the thousands and thousands, you know, it's going to look pretty challenging in Beijing for them to go, well, what do we do now? Do we wait until, you know, for 5 or 10 years when we have an even more capable force? Or do we think about doing something now when we have a less capable force than what we could be, but it's before the Taiwanese get absolutely armed to the teeth? So, you know, it's just one of those real knife-edge situations that could really, you know, kick off if the wrong thing happened and, you know, cooler heads didn't prevail.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there are lots of cross currents, as I've said a few times, and some of them are very concerning. But of course, here in Australia, and I just refer to Tasmania, what was the announcement this week? It was actually to provide more first-time buyer grants, to give more access, shared equity. So, you know, the local politicians are still thinking about propping up the property market. So that's where their focus is.
Well, you know, I mean, that is really the key, isn't it? I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the Australian list of priorities, it's propping up the property market, locally made reality television, five or six different things, then it's war in the Ukraine, inflation, global markets, etc. You know, I mean, maybe that's the RBA's list too. I don't know.
It certainly seems to be, but I have to say that when I saw that yesterday, I mean, I actually tweeted saying, "Well, why don't we just nationalise property, right? Because frankly, we've got so much taxpayers' money flowing in to try and keep this property bubble going. Let's just go the whole hog." You know, maybe that's the answer.
It's a ridiculous state of affairs. You know, I mean, we have a property sector. You know, residential property now is worth $10 trillion.
Mm.
You know, it's worth 500% of GDP. Now, prior, you know, around the time of the peak of US markets, every company in America, every listed company on all the US exchanges, their market cap plus every single residential property in the US was, I believe, 390% of GDP.
Yep.
So our housing market, in relative terms, is worth 110%. Of GDP more than every single productively listed company in America and every single house.
Yep.
It's just, you know, we talk about a stock bubble. We talk about a stock bubble, yet our housing bubble is almost twice the size of their stock market. Yep. Relative to GDP. It's almost unfathomable.
Well, that's the point. It's become too big to fail, which is why then state and federal governments just throw more and more money at more and more schemes to try and drag more and more people in. As I always say to, you know, when people are thinking, first-time buyers, for example, thinking of getting on the bandwagon, right, remember that why they're doing it. They're not doing it to help you, and they're not doing it to, you know, help housing affordability. They're doing it to prop the bubble up, and they're doing it because it's politically seen as a good thing to do. But it is a very bad thing to do because it continues to lift house prices. It continues to put yet more pressure on households, and it doesn't solve our fundamental economic problems that we've got here, let alone, you know, in the context of all the things we've been talking today about higher inflation, et cetera, et cetera. It is so myopic. It's so stupid. And yet I reckon that we probably spend more brain cells thinking about property and property related things in Australia compared with everything else. It's just crazy.
It is. And one of the things I think is interesting is I don't think I've ever seen a poll, like an independently done poll, you know, done in any real depth into whether people actually want to see rising housing prices, whether or not they're relatively happy with their lot and they're concerned about their kids or their friends or their family affording a property. Now, the only large scale polls that I have seen have been done in conjunction with my articles on news.com.au. And those suggest that a majority of Australians don't want higher housing prices.
Yep.
And if you factor in the people who are just happy to have housing prices stagnate where they are, that becomes then a large majority of people, which raises the question, are the politicians doing it for the voters? Because they're not idiots. I guarantee they've got their own polling, their own private stuff that they've done, and they know. Are they doing it for the electorate out of some misguided perception? Or are they doing it for some other reason?
Well, quite a few of them have their own properties, their own property portfolios, point one, right? Point two, in my surveys, I do touch on some of those things, and you see a philosophical disconnect. Strategically, people would say, no, we know that prices are very overextended, we know that debt's very high, and we don't want to see that going further. But when you talk about personal wealth and their own personal situation, it's completely different, right? Because they actually want to feel wealthy. And their biggest asset by far is the property that's expanded in value for no particular reason, just while they were asleep at night, right? That's the problem. We've got a disconnect between those two worlds, right? And unfortunately, my view is that whilst philosophically a lot of people are aligned to the view that, yeah, prices are too high, right? When it comes to the ballot box and when it comes to actually those votes, a lot of people will vote for their own personal wealth. And if they think they're actually going to see property prices fall under one party versus the other, they probably won't vote for them. And of course, at the moment, everybody's wanting to talk property prices up and talking about helping more people get into the market to keep the bubble going, because both sides of politics are wired to the same plot here. That's the problem. So there is a disconnect, but I think it's a bit more subtle than just everybody saying, well, that's fine, you know, we should let prices go sideways, I'm happy to accept that. I think philosophically they might at one level agree, but when it comes to the hip pocket, different story.
Well, I must admit it, there is some interesting mental gymnastics in that regard, because you talk to people who bought these properties for $9 back in like the early to mid 1980s. And then you talk to them about their children, you know, and they say, oh, my children, they can't afford the house around, you know, to be near me and for me to be near my grandchildren, and the house is 2.4, 2.5, or even a mil, you know, even like $1.2, $1.3 million, because the median Australian household sure as hell can't afford a $1 million house.
Correct.
It's just it's just impossible. But there's just that disconnect, you know, they just sit there watching location or whatever other property show, and they go, oh yeah, $2 million, that seems reasonable. I mean, here's a little game that I suggest that people can play at home. look at the houses of in your area, and then look at the cars in those areas, in those driveways. Right now, I know that there are people out there who don't really care about cars, who just, you know, they're not interested in keeping up with the Joneses. Right. But if you go to the US and you go to an affluent area, you're going to see Corvettes, Jags, Ferraris, Lambos, Beamers, Audis, etc. You do the same thing here in Australia. You drive around, say, Sydney's Northern Beaches, for example, is a good one, especially up towards the northern end. You see some of those houses there. They've got $4 or $5 million, and they're driving around in cars that'd be more expensive than some people's lunches. Sorry, less expensive than some people's lunches.
I was going to say less expensive, yeah.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, if you ask all these people in some of these houses to rebuy their houses at the current price, even at their absolute peak income, good luck.
Yeah.
Wouldn't happen. Wouldn't happen for a lot of folks.
And it's worth just remembering that paper value of the property, you know, what it might or might not be worth, is irrelevant until you actually come to transact.
Yeah.
All right. And it's worth just thinking about this. If some of those broader economic things that we've been talking about come through and inflation gets some, you know, away from us, and interest rates have to go up, that's when prices will come back. And, you know, no amount of government stimulus will save it. So ultimately, I suspect that in amongst of all of those Hollywood stories, right, there might be a property crash just over the horizon.
Well, it's gonna be interesting, because, you know, we're gonna see a lot more pretending from you know, certain people in the halls of power that everything is fine and that inflation isn't a major issue. But, you know, I think it's gonna be a fascinating one. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things is from on that point is the discussion we had last week towards the end of our chat about wages growth.
Yep.
About how if wages growth doesn't pick up, you could potentially see a scenario in which the RBA lets inflation run, especially now with the Australian dollar getting stronger. So, you know, I mean, there is a scenario there whereby, you know, the conclusions we've come to in terms of the economy being fundamentally broken and wages being fundamentally broken as a transmission mechanism could keep rates low and keep housing prices high, which is just frankly insane. You know, the idea that we could keep housing prices high and wages low while inflation just absolutely mauls us. But, you know, I mean, who knows how much, you know, who knows how much the government and the RBA is going to be willing to throw at the market. Like you said last week, you know, TFF 2.0 perhaps.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, interesting times as always. I appreciate your insights, Sir Tarek, and your charts. Another great chat, I think. Thank you. And we'll keep watching and listening, and we'll do another one down the track.
Yeah, definitely. I think we say this every time, but there's going to be plenty to talk about.
Oh, there always is. Thank you, sir. So see you soon.
No worries, mate. Catch you later.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.